All right. Tonight's speaker is Candido, and he's from the underground group in Philadelphia.
My name is Candido. I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is January 27, 2004. Sober by the grace of God. And I'm only sober this long by the grace of God. I can actually say that the grace of God doesn't enter a dirty heart. And, you know, I battled alcoholism for a long time. I was born in Philadelphia, pushed out in a small town called Ambler in Montgomery County. Graduated from Wissahickon High School in 1984. And, you know, I wasn't one of the ones that individuals that picked up a drink at a young age. Like, I didn't pick up a drink at 9, 13. Like, I didn't get involved with drinking alcohol until, you know, I was 18, 1984, my last year in high school. Wasn't really a good kid in school. And, you know, I took a course up at North Penn Vocational Tech School to get out of the half of the classes in Wissahickon High School. And, you know, I had this nervous disposition about going to vocational tech school, even though I took it to get out of some classes in regular high school. And so a friend of mine named Luther and used to bring these little bottles of liquor in. And at lunchtime, I used to put them in my apple juice, grape juice, orange juice, whatever juice I had. And, you know, it made me feel good. You know what I mean? Like, it made me start to joke with individuals. Like, I went to school with all Caucasians, a few blacks, you know, it's no problem. But, like, I always sat in the back of the class just in case I got called on. Like, I didn't want to look like I was some stupid dude that didn't know the answer, because actually I wasn't real smart. But I graduated high school, and, you know, I graduated in 1984, and the only, like, education that I knew that could service me was to work at the Pike Restaurant in Springhouse. And I became a dishwasher. And, you know, I had the type supervisor that used to bring German beer in every Friday, every Saturday I worked. St. Pauli's girls, Beck's, Heineken, didn't matter. And, you know, I didn't drink alcoholically in the beginning. And, you know, like, this supervisor also, in passing, brought something else in, which enabled me to drink a lot more. And, you know what, like, I used to travel from Ambler back to Mount Airy because my mother lived in Philadelphia, but she couldn't work for the city of Philadelphia if she lived in Montgomery County. So, you know, my grandmother practically raised me, and I used to travel back and forth to Mount Airy to visit her. And, you know, I remember traveling back and forth one day, and this dude named Rob Jones asked me if I needed a job. And, like, I was thinking to myself, like, anything beats dishwashing. You know what I mean? And, he was like, okay, meet me at this schoolyard. I met him at McCluskey Schoolyard, and he gave me a paper bag, and inside the paper bag was a sandwich bag, and inside the sandwich bag was these little cellophane bags. And he wanted me to distribute them when people walked up to me with $20. And at the particular time in 1985, this particular intoxicant was on the rise. So I wasn't making any money in Philadelphia. So I had a bright idea to take this intoxicant back up an Ambler and sell it for a lot more. And that's when I had that little power struggle. I mean, that power structure, like, I became somebody I wasn't in high school. In high school, I was some short, curly-haired dude that the girls didn't look at. Now I got my cut, my hair cut nice, and, you know, I got a nice car, and I'm wearing these T.I. sweatsuits and Lecoq Sportif sweatsuits and things like that. And, you know, the gold and the jewelry and the girls started to notice me. And now, like, I could throw my own keg parties. Because my brother, may God have mercy on his soul, used to throw keg parties. He was real tight with the Caucasians. Like, I was tight with him to a certain extent, you know. But I didn't actually even get with my first girlfriend until I was 18. And you know what? But now, like, I had the power. I could throw the keg parties. Because up in Amber, PA, we didn't get 40s and go to the corner and politic and bust it up. You got beer balls, Genesee cream ale, you got kegs. You paid a dollar, you got a cup, and we drank until the keg, until the keg was gone. Paid $11, you got the tap, you get, took the tap back, you got $11 on the next keg. And that's how we drank, you know. But I had this particular substance that enabled, like, the girls just to bow down to me, man. And it was sweet for a while. And, you know, so from 1985 to 1988, you know, got into all kinds of intoxicants, solids, gaseous substances, liquids, all this AA non-approved stuff. I couldn't accept that I was an alcoholic, though. So I remember, like, you know, indulging in what I was distributing. And, you know, it made me talk a lot. And if the alcohol wasn't there, I wasn't talking a lot. So it was like bacon and eggs. I couldn't have one without the other. And, you know what? Like, so that went on for a while. And I remember this dude named Leroy Goins, you know, told me specifically, he said, I got a cousin in Ohio, and, you know, out in Ohio, they're paying like $1,600 an ounce, and you can give it to him for maybe $750. And I wound up dealing with this individual for 9 months. And so I dealt with him for 9 months. And I remember early in the morning, like 5:30, somebody knocking on the door, my grandmother's door, real hard. I come downstairs and I see the dude, Ted, that I was distributing to, and he had a dude on the side of him. The same dude that, you know, that I was handing this distributing to, flashed the badge with his right hand. And I was just thinking, like, damn, who hooked me up with this dude? Leroy. Leroy hooked me up with this dude, and so I remember, like, making a distribution, not on the Montgomery County side. I didn't catch a Montgomery County charge. I met him up Cheltenham on the Philadelphia side, near this bar called Jarrett's Lounge, and so I didn't catch the Montgomery County charge, because, you know, Montgomery, they got a 98% conviction rate. I'd probably still be there today. Nobody gets off. So, you know what, like, I got locked up, and I got taken to detention center, and I stayed there, and you know what, like, I used to have a lot of fear instilled in me about what individuals in prison were talking about. They were talking about dudes light-skinned with pretty hair getting raped up and graded for it. So, you know what, I stayed there 2 weeks, and I got bailed out, and I had a lot of fear that these nine such-and-such ounces of yayo was going to put me in jail for a long time. And you know what? Like, so that fear enabled me to drink a lot more. Enabled me to do a lot more other things. And I got into some things which I thought I was never going to get into. Like, I didn't think I would become what these people had became, because these people had became like rats. They ran in circles, and they took their mom's VCRs and CDs, and they brought them to me. And now I'm on the opposite side of that phone. I'm that same dude through the alcohol. I was now bringing my stuff to other individuals. You know, the Lecoq Sportif sweatsuits and the TI sweatsuits, and no longer getting right haircuts. And you know what? Like, because that fear set in about me happened to go to Graterford to do some time, enabled me to drink a lot more and do a lot more other AA non-approved substances. And so you know what? Like, I remember, like, 1990, I finally got that moment of clarity. And, you know, because I know if I went to rehab, when I come up in front of the judge, he's not going to give me that long. Probably give me county time. But I went to rehab not accepting that I was an alcoholic. I knew I had problems with other stuff, but I'm not alcohol. So I went to the Riverside House on State Road and Milner Street in the Northeast Philadelphia. And I stayed there for 28 days. And I made the almost fatal mistake of getting involved with a rehab relationship. And the focus was now more on her then it was on me. I seen those there. It's all corny to me. You know what I mean? I wasn't there because I was an alcoholic. I'm there because I'm a drug addict. And, you know, I got out and 1991 comes around and, you know, I had some dry time. I didn't do any work in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had some dry time and I picked up that fatal first drink again. And she did. And we went to a couple meetings together and I was on the well-known stages of a spree like the doctor's opinion talks about. And you know what? Like, she left. And, you know, you don't want to be around me when I'm drinking and doing other intoxicants because I will rob you blind. And that's what I do when I'm drinking. And, you know what? So I had a good lawyer, Howard Popper, you know, who told me the best deal they can give me is 3 to 6. So I went up in front of Judge Darnell Jones III, and he sentenced me to 3 to 6. Actually, saved my life because once an alcoholic of the hopeless variety releases that phenomenon of craving, the phenomenon of craving says stop when it says stop. So jail actually saved me going to prison because I was on the well-known stages of a spree again. And so there I go to Greater Ford. I'm there for 8 months on C block. And then I go to Camp Hill. And, you know, I'm in Camp Hill. And then I get these letters from the parole board that I had to do an alcohol and drug treatment plan, and I had to do these relapse prevention and all this other stuff that I had to do in order for me to get released on my minimum. And I only did those things to get released on my minimum. I didn't really accept that I was an alcoholic in prison. I didn't indulge in people taking, didn't indulge in sine qua nons like other people were doing in prison. I didn't indulge in getting high or drinking prison wine in prison. Just wasn't, you know, just didn't look right to me. So, you know, I stay at Camp Hill for 16 months, and then they transfer me to this little minimum joint called Retreat, which is in Scranton. And I get out in 1994, but before getting released, my mom had traveled from Mount Airy to South Philadelphia. 13th from Federal, where we are today, you know. You know, when I was getting these letters from this chick named Karen, she's got like 17 years, you know, and she was sending me these letters about this particular program. You know, it wasn't Alcoholics Anonymous, it wasn't Narcotics Anonymous. They made like a little set that deviated from Alcoholics Anonymous, and they called themselves Addicts Anonymous. Which is on 13th and Tasker, right around the corner from my house. And they used the big book as directions to stay sober. You know, and they told me I had to get 2 sponsors and I had to get a book. And I got 2 sponsors by name only. And all my book did was collect dust because I thought that stuff was corny. I thought that book stuff was real corny. Like, I'm not in high school anymore, so why I got to do this? And, you know what? Like, you know, from the forced recovery time that I had in prison, because it's forced time. I didn't drink or nothing, but it's forced time. You know what I mean? Like, I wasn't subject to a lot of the stuff in the outside world like I was when I was out in the world. And, you know, from about the year that I had on the street, I got a job for this dude named Jerry Epps. His name's anonymous because he's one of us. And, you know, I was the laborer at first. And then I, like, upgraded to brick pointer. Did real well for myself from not having really much of an education. And, you know what? Like, I had this other dude that was laboring, and I was actually brick pointing my own houses in the South Philadelphia regional area. And you know what? I remember it was on a Friday. It was October 1st, 1995. And I remember Jerry comes around, and he says, Candido, I got to take him. I need you to clean up. Take everything back to the garage. I'm a brick pointer. I'm not a laborer anymore. That ego that I had and that pride that I had that I didn't want to clean up the job site and take the stuff back to the garage enabled me that night from a little bit of anger, slight resentment, which is anger, led me to pick up a drink October 1st, 1995. And I picked up that fatal first drink. And I remember, like, picking up that fatal first drink. Now I'm in South Philadelphia. And I'm drinking. And when I drink, I run out of money. I don't know money. I don't go home with a dollar. I drink until the last bit of my cash is gone. So I'm drinking and I run out of money. And now I'm going to every other bar in the city because I'm trashed. You know what? Like, you know, taking money off the bar. Not literally taking it, like, give me that. I'm talking about if it was some ones on top of a 50, like, I would go sit next to the dude, look around, act like I'm looking at the TV, lick my finger. If he's on the right of me, I'm on the left of him. And if he's turning to the right, I'm slipping that $50 bill. I'm getting away with it from Patterson Avenue all the way down to South Street. And I'm, you know what, and I'm, like I said, I'm drinking until the money is gone. Ran out of money again. This time I go to a bar, which is five blocks down the street from my house on 9th and Federal. That in 1995, if you're a person of color, black, Puerto Rican, Mexican, Chinese, whatever, this is a bar that you don't go to. Called Ray's Bar on 9th and Federal, right down the street from Gino's Steaks. And I go there because the alcohol told me that I could go there. And, you know, I seen $100 bill. And I was like, damn, that was mine. You know, the flying eagles that we get when we succumb to having some money. When obsession meets money, when cash, obsession meets cash, you get that funny, queasy feeling in your stomach. You know what I mean? I call them flying eagles. I didn't know they were a beginning of an obsession, which is the thought that dominates every other thought. So I remember slipping $100. And I was like, man, got it. I walked out the door, and that's all I remember. I got shot in the face, and I got stabbed in the stomach. They left me in the front of the middle of Federal Street, blocked off. I left me for dead, took my wallet. They didn't know who I was. I was John Doe at Jefferson Hospital. My mom called every hospital around, and they said, we got a John Doe down here. If you want to come check him out, if he's your son or not, and it wind up being me. I had a severed salivary gland from the bullet wound. Took out my two front, they're implants now, but I still look good, though. You know. Took out my two front. Severed salivary gland. A salivary gland is what gives you your saliva. I wasn't getting any saliva from the left side of my face. My jaw was broke. It was out to here. From the stab wound in my stomach, I had small and large bowel obstructions, meaning that my digestive tract was closed. There was no solid liquid flowing through my bloodstream, through my digestive system. I had to eat out this catheter. It's called a Hickman catheter. And they hooked it up to my shoulder, and I could eat out of Alice's bag. And I'm there for like 7 months because, you know, the stomach wounds were very, very, very harmful. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I had to have surgery after surgery just to get, like, this digestive tract back on track. And, you know what? Still didn't do it. And at the particular time, 1995, I had HealthPass, which is affiliated with welfare. And, you know, my bill was $1.5 million. And they sent the letter to my mom. They sent the letter to the hospital. They were unable to pay for any more stays at the hospital. So they did give me this blessing. They allowed me to go home with a visiting nurse who showed me how to hook up this Hickman catheter during my nighttime while I sleep, get this nutrient in my body so I can go about doing what I wanted to do. And I remember the particular group, the two sponsors that I did have by name only, coming to visit me like, Candido, you done yet? You know, when we're in that predicament, of course I'm going to say I'm done. You know what I mean? So I remember, like, I could go out during the day, make meetings, get with these two guys, go through the book. I didn't do none of that. Instead, I caught myself around a cipher of dudes who were drinking 40 ounces in Philadelphia on the corner, smoking these things called blunts. And not knowing that my digestive tract is closed. I am unable to eat or drink anything. And I remember, like, they didn't know I was a full-blown alcoholic, these dudes. They just knew I moved to the neighborhood. I was somewhat cool. And, you know what? I remember, like, the blunt came my way. I reneged on that. Like, because that stuff made me, like, nervous and scary. And, you know, that was never my twist. So, but when the 40 came my way, the 40-ounce of beer came my way. Cokie 900 now, not OE. Cokie 900 came my way. Forget about the digestive tract. I didn't really think about that this is not going to be able to digest through my system. But the thought, there's three types of mental states preceding the fatal first drink. There's the thought, which is fleeting. There's the sudden thought, which is a mental blank spot. And there's the obsession, which is the thought that dominates every other thought. I fell victim to a mental blank spot that all of a sudden thought that, let me get this 40. It might help me. So I drink the 40, drink a little bit of it, drink some more. It gets stuck on the left side of my stomach. I told the boys, yo, I'll be right back. I go to the bathroom. Went around the corner on Clarion Street. We're on Federal at the near Frank's Bar. Went around the corner on Federal Clarion Street. Put my finger down my throat. Just to throw off the alcohol because it wasn't hitting my bloodstream. Come back around the corner, take the 40 again. Go back on Clarence Street, stick my finger down my throat to throw it up. In the book, it talks about men and women drink for the effect produced by alcohol. I wasn't getting that effect because it wasn't digesting and it wasn't going in my blood system. So I went to another intoxicant. Caught myself back on the well-known stages of a spree again. After all that, what I went through, I went back out there on the well-known stages of a spree. And I didn't get that moment of clarity until the beginning of 1996. And I'm in South Philly, totally alienated from Ambler and Mount Airy. I know those people. But when I'm drinking, I'll drink with anybody. I don't care about the people that come to Alcoholics Anonymous and say, I'll never drink with you. Shit, I drink with anybody. You got a couple dollars, I'm drinking with you. So, you know, I get this moment of clarity, and I walk down to the DRC, Diagnostic Rehabilitation Center, 229 Arch Street. And now, mind you, December 29th, 1994, my grandmother tragically drowned in Lombard Nursing Home on 15th and Lombard. The nurse, the RPM, left the room. She was giving my grandmother a bath. Her head went underwater. She left the room. She came back. She was dead. So my mom was good ready to sue in the process of suing Geriatric Medical Corporation for a hell of a lot of money. So, fear sobered me up. Just like in Bill's story, it says, fear sobered me up a bit. Yes, fear sobered me up a bit when I went to DRC because I knew if I were to continue drinking, I would never see any of that money. So, I stayed there 42 days. I stayed there 42 days. Now, after the 42nd day, they want me to go to this place called Washington House on 15th and Washington. I'm on Federal. Here goes Ellsworth. Here goes Washington. I'm right around the corner from where I drank at. So I'm scared to death. So I go there anyway. I go there, and you know what? Like, the intense obsession was removed. God had blessed me and removed that intense obsession. But I don't know how long it was going to be removed, so I moved up to State Road, Princeton Avenue and State Road, up in the northeast Philadelphia. And I became a proud member of this particular group called the Stepping Stones Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. A lot of bikers, a lot of Harley Davidson dudes, a lot of gangs, biker gangs, and you know what? These dudes were sober. You know what I mean? It was like a real inspiration. And you know what? Like, I grabbed onto a sponsor. His name was Bud R. He died with 37 years of continuous sobriety. And he always used to tell me, read the acceptance piece in the back. Sit up front. Treat it like handicapped parking. Sit up front because you don't know nothing. Shut up. And That's what I did. 2.5 years went by. Me being up there. My mom gave me part of my money. You know, I got a nice little 1997 Saab green. And, you know, I started to go to meetings late and leave early. You know what? I wasn't staying for the whole meeting. And I remember, like, I was at the Stepping Stones, and this dude named Thomas C. was speaking. And I got 2.5 years of sobriety. Let's call it that. I got 2.5 years of sobriety. And he said before, there's a break after the speaker. He said, would anybody really feel like drinking before we take this break? And deep down in my heart, I had that thought in the back of my head that I could drink successfully. So I left at the break. I didn't share about it. I've never shared about it. I left at the break, caught myself driving all around downtown, city of Philadelphia, going to bars, drinking soda, you know what I mean, trying to get on chicks, you know what I mean. And I remember driving down South Street. I'm on like 5th and South. And I'm driving down, and I seen these chicks go up in Fat Tuesdays. And I was like, damn, I got to get up in there. So I pull over. I go up in Fat Tuesdays. I feel alienated. I'm the only dude without a cup in his hand. So I'm thinking like, okay, I went to prior bars before this bar and drank soda. So I go up to the bartender. And I said, can I get a Coca-Cola, please? And she says, we don't sell soda here, son. Would you like anything else? 3 types of mental states preceding the fatal first drink. The thought, which is fleeting. The sudden thought, which is a mental blank spot. And the obsession, which is the thought that dominates every other thought. Once again, I fell victim to that mental blank spot. I said, okay. Let me get a strawberry daiquiri. Thinking it was going to be like a mystic. But in our literature, in our blessed book that we have, it says that once an alcoholic takes any type of alcohol into his system, something happens bodily and mentally. Something happened in Fat Tuesdays that always happened. Because I needed to go somewhere else. 2 o'clock in the morning comes around. And I'm thinking, like, where can I go? Somebody's mentioning, go to a Palmer's nightclub. It's open till 3:30. I'll go to Palmer's nightclub. I'll drive up there. I got $1,600 in my pocket. Drive up there. And it's this, you know, it's the homosexual dude. I got nothing against them. He's running around Palmer's nightclub selling an intoxicant. Now, and I'm buying vodka and cranberries now. Now, the Eagle cheerleaders are there. Yeah, it's a unisex bathroom. You know what I mean? Why not have with this guy is running around hustling to go with my vodka and cranberry? Go in the bathroom, you know, unisex bathroom, Eagle cheerleaders in there getting their thing on. I need my head telling me, like, yeah, I'm going to have fun tonight. Come out the bathroom. The drinks were still there, but the other particular intoxicant wasn't there. And I couldn't find the dude that was running around hustling it. Because like I told you in the beginning, it was like bacon and eggs. I couldn't have one without the other. So 3:30 in the morning comes around. I'm trashed, but I'm still like feeling right about here because of this other intoxicant. It leveled me off. But I don't have any more, so I got to drive around the city and try to find something. And don't you know I ended up on 17th and Dickinson in the crack house. Everything that I acquired from the 2.5 years of sobriety went up in smoke. The new sneakers that I had on in that house got traded off. The car, I lent the car out and never seen the car again in my life. Mind you, my mom had a nice establishment of money. She bought a house up in Bushkill, PA, so I go up there, try to get sober. Geographical change, that'll work. Man, I'm in Bushkill, and you know what? I got one of her cars, and I'm driving down Stroudsburg. And Stroudsburg, it looks like, you know, some parts of Stroudsburg look like North Philly, man. And I'm like, but they're all from New York. So I see the dude with the baseball cap with the baggy pants, and you know what I mean? It looked like they're having a good time, so I play Joe Familia. Joe Familia means I go up to him and act like I really know him, and I really don't. So I'm getting loaded up in Bushkill. Same cycle, vicious cycle that I started off with all the way down back when I picked up that strawberry daiquiri in Fat Tuesdays. So I told my mom, you got to come get me. I'm in the same predicament up here that I was in Philadelphia. Okay. So my brother, may God again have mercy on his soul, had, told me I could live with him. And I remember living with him. He was a bar back at Rock Lobster, and, you know, he brought by a whole bunch of cash. And, you know, I was disgusted because money was the trigger for me. I could stay sober broke, but give me a couple dollars, and I play with that thought. I entertain or masturbate the thought of drinking. I'm out of here. I'm going to drink. So I remember being broke back down Philadelphia in the first floor apartment with my brother. He had a couple dollars in his shoe. You know, him and his girl asleep. I open the door, you know, hoping they didn't hear it. I crawl in the room. I look in the shoe. I grab a knot for like $2.50. I grab a knot, and I'm back on the well-known stages of a spree again in South Philly. The same thing that happened to me up 17th for Dickinson happened again when I came back down from Bushkill. And this time it's early in the morning. You know, we're vampires. We don't like when the sun comes up. Sun is up. I hate that. I got to keep going. No more money. Let me go back home. You know what I mean? Get some sleep. Try anyway. I used my key. The door was locked. Couldn't get in. I look on the stoop and there's a bag with a note and a jar of peanut butter. Like, you're no longer welcome here. We don't want to see you no more. Don't come back here. I will put a restraining order out on you. My mother left me this note. And so I didn't have any money. I had this bag of clothes. I had a jar of peanut butter. And, you know, I'm walking all around Center City. I wind up down 2nd and Market. And I said, let me get on one of these buses just to see where it would take me. So I get on the 5 bus. And it takes me all the way up Kensington Avenue. Here we go, yes. Go all the way up past Lehigh. We're coming in front of Martin's Deli on Kensington and Somerset. And I see a whole bunch of hopeless alcoholics just like me. Bus driver, can you let me off right here? I get off at Kensington and Somerset. I wind up being stuck in a house on Rutledge and Cambria. On C and Cambria, Rutledge, C, Cambria, for 3.5 years, stuck in a bandit house. The girls from the Avenue who went to do what they had to do to get just one more was taking care of me. Because now I was fooling with something that was much more violent than alcohol. And I was sick when I couldn't get it, in passing. So what? From the beginning of 1999 to December 22nd, 2001, I was out, stuck on Kensington Avenue, running from Kensington to Tioga to Kensington and Somerset, Kensington and Huntington to Kensington and Somerset, like a rat. And they finally locked me up, man. They locked me up. And you know what? That's because I was trying to put my street pharmaceutical game back in progress again. But it didn't work. And I got caught right away. And you know what? Like, they took me to detention center. And you know what? Like, I had a case that they said that I had a real heinous crime. And you know what? Like, I wound up sitting for 39 months for that on B block in detention center, which is a hole for administrative custody. And, you know, I had Judge Lillian Ransom Harris, whose husband is Judge Darnell Jones III, that I had in 1991. And she looks at my record and she says, Mr. Gonzalez, like, you don't learn. You had my husband back in 91 and now you're in front of me. So So she sentenced me to 9 to 23 months, immediately followed by a FIR program, Forensic Intensive Recovery Program. So I get out and I go to this place called New Start, 15th and Erie. I can wrap it up. It's 15th and Erie. I'm getting to the solution now. 15th and Erie, and now I'm at 15th and Erie. I'm with these dudes that are pulling the psych med thing. They're getting Cinequan and all kinds of stuff. I pull the psych med thing, and I'm getting Trazodone. Now, Trazodone is something equal, if you take enough of it, to alcohol. 9 months, I graduated that program. They said I wasn't allowed home yet. Christopher Kelly, my parole officer, said I wasn't allowed home yet. Told me to go back down Diagnostic Rehabilitation Center, 229 Arch Street, the first floor this time. You're going to be there until I say you can leave. Second day there, I get an obsession. Not no sudden thought, not no mental blank spot, not just a thought. I get an obsession, which is that thought that dominates every other thought. And I go in the L, and I get off at Kensington and Allegheny. And you know the rest. And I come back down, you know, that fatal first drink got me. I wind up being blue in my room. My roommate wind up calling Vanessa Poe, the director of the first floor. And she called the ambulance, and they hit me with something to revive me. Something called Narcon that revived me. And they took me to Jefferson Hospital, put me on the 14th floor after they checked me out, and put me in a psychiatric ward. I'm there for the weekend. This is on Friday. Fridays is bad for me. This is on Friday. I'm there for the weekend. Before you know it, like, the doctor comes out and says, Mr. Gonzalez, we don't think that you have a psychiatric problem. We know that you have an alcohol addiction. By the way, here's the token. By the way, Christopher Kelly, your parole officer, wants to see you, 1401 Arch Street, 9th floor mental health unit. So I go see him. Now, when you're FIR, they have automatically got to lock you up. I go see him, knowing that I just released that phenomenon of craving. I see him for 5 minutes. He asked me what happened. Before you know it, I'm against the wall. Put your hands behind your back. Took me down to the basement. Took me to CFCF this time. I'm on quarantine. Before you know it, I go to C21. I got a cellie named Tito G that was going to visit every Tuesday, swallowing balloons, and I'm getting loaded in jail. Getting loaded in jail for 27 days before Judge Lillian Ransom Harris sends me a letter. Says, Mr. Gonzalez, being though you violated a FIR program, you now got to do 90 days on a drug treatment options block. Saved my life. This dude on Wednesday, Alcoholics Anonymous, came up to share the message of hope. And I heard a message of hope. This dude named Jason K. shared about what's the program of action in Alcoholics Anonymous. Something that I wasn't used to hearing. I wasn't used to hearing that. So, I get out. First sends me to Keystone Center on Providence Road in Chester. I'm there 52 days because I'm FIR. Scheduled back to Philadelphia. I go to a halfway house up in Upper Darby called the Hardwood House. For fighting, I get kicked out of there. Call Christopher Kelly, my parole officer. Okay, see if they get you another house. Went back to another house up in Chester. Fighting in there because of my attitudes, my behaviors. I get kicked out again. This time, Christopher Kelly says, okay, go back home. I told him my brother has an apartment open. My brother welcomed me with open arms. Because I'm his brother. He loves me. And I went back down there. And you know what? Like, I had already 11 months of continuous sobriety. Up in these, let's say, sobriety again. Up in these houses. So I go back downtown. And I go to this meeting on Tuesday, which is the beginner's big book study. The underground group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I seen this dude named John H. there. And I said, man. Like, I haven't seen you since 96. I was like, you still sober? He was like, yeah. I was like, damn, like, what did you do that I didn't do? He says, have you ever experienced the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous? I said, no. I heard of them. I read them. He said, has anybody sat you down, took you page through page, chapter through chapter, paragraph through paragraph, through the book? I said, no. He said, what's the use of being in a 12-step program and not experiencing steps? Even a fool can see that. So we got together. We got together. My first meeting with him was on 19th and Walnut at Cozy's Coffee Center. Coffee shop. Now allow me to display God's my sponsors and AA's excellence. Most importantly, the directions as outlined in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. First he took me to, it is indicated that one alcoholic with another is vital for permanent recovery. I said, what's that mean? He said, Candido, what's your sobriety? I said, January 27, 2004. He said, that first day is the soberest you're ever going to get. You're not going to get super sober 30 days later. He said, you need to find something to transmit, sit down with another alcoholic and take them through it. Didn't quite understand it, but that's what he said. Took me through the doctor's opinion where it talks about we who have suffered alcoholic torture must, the third must in the doctor's opinion, must believe that the body of an alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. He said, Candido, if you don't believe that your body is just as twisted as your mind, we can't go on with the rest of the book. I came to that conclusion that there was physically something wrong with me. Physically something wrong with me. And he took me to the part where it talks about these allergic types could never safely use alcohol in any form. I didn't even know what an allergy was. I know what somebody's allergic to fish do, their lips swell up. Somebody in strawberries, they break out in the hives. I didn't even know that. He said, your allergic reaction that you pick up any minor mood altering chemical and you are completely unable to stop. I said, yes. Then he matched the physical ailment with the mental ailment. So, skip Bill's story, skip their solution, took me straight to more about alcohol, the first step. I had to fully concede to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. The delusion that I was like other people, or presently maybe, had to be smashed. He broke that guy, he said, Candido, remember dudes that you could drink with and do lines with and stay up all night and then all of a sudden they going to work? I said, yeah. He said, you're not like them. I don't go to work. I go to Kensington Avenue. So I accepted the first step. Just an acceptance piece. Minute we were powerless over alcohol. Yes, I'm powerless. My life is unmanageable. What's unmanageable about my life? Oh, I can't. I don't have a job. I can't pay bills. He said, yeah, that's part of it. He said, let's look at the inward unmanageability. Outlined on page 52 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Having trouble with personal relationships. Couldn't control our emotional natures. Prey to misery and depression. Full of fear. He said the opposite of this is on page 84. 4 through 9 will get you there. I said, what? He said, yeah. So you know what? Can't you believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity? The sanity that I was restored to was that any problem that occurred, I no longer had to drink and turn to drinking and drugging to solve that particular problem. And that obsession was dissipated. Step to the second step. And how did I step that? When it says that, you know, basically what is this book is about? This book's main objective is to enable me to find a power but greater than myself by which I can live. So let's go on with the rest of the book. Took me to how it works. And it talks about like God is going to be our director. We are his agents. You know what I mean? We are his children. He is the father. Then it says establish. It says, you know, established on such a footing, we became less interested in our little plans and designs. Took me to the third step prayer where I bring Athens at a 56th anniversary meeting and he's telling me to get in his truck. I said, all right, let's go to the truck. He said, hold my hand. Hold your hand. We didn't have time to hit our knees because we wanted to get back out and hear the person with 44 years of sobriety. Hold my hand. We recited the third step prayer. Made that decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood them. What is my will and what is my life? My thinking and my actions. My actions had to change first before my thinking changed. Right action leads to right thinking. And I was making that decision only to go on with the rest of the work. And it says, though our decision is a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless followed by a strenuous effort to be rid of the things in ourselves which was blocking us. Blocking us from what? Blocking us from God. All that dirt I did on Kensington Avenue. All that selfish stuff I did to get a drink. I had to now give it away. Took me to the fourth step. Made a decision to turn. Made a searching and fearless decision. Made a searching and fearless more inventory of ourselves. I had to write down all my resentments. Whoever I was mad at, my sponsor told me write them down. I had like 68 resentments. And he made me look at my part in every resentment. Crazy ass sexual conduct. A lot of fears, too many harms. I wrote my fourth step in 4.5 hours. I had to get down to the nitty gritty and get right down deep with it. I wrote it at his house in 4.5 hours. Sold my fifth in 3.5 hours. Put it together, that's 8 hours. That's a day's work. And you know what? After I told him my fifth step and he told me some of his, like, the fears started to fall from me. You know what? I started to feel the presence of God. The presence. I started to feel that because all this stuff that was holding me down was now released. He said, get with me at the corner of 19th and Warner before we go to this beginner's meet. And I'm going to give you the six-step outline. Took me there. Took me to the book. It's just a 6- and 7-step prayer. Just a prayer. And he taught me how to pray. How did he taught me how to pray when I've been Islamic all my life? How did he do that? He says, Candida, when you were praying from the mind. You were only hoping that God was going to give you what you want. But now, we're going to start praying for from the heart. Where so you know for a surety that he's going to give you whatever you ask. So ask God. I'm willing that you have all of me, the good and bad. I pray you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Give me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. What stands in the way of my usefulness to God and my fellows? Most importantly, again, like it said in How It Works, selfishness and self-centeredness. Always will stand in the way of my usefulness to God and you people. I started to supplicate the God of my understanding with this prayer and all my character defects. Majority of them have fallen from me. Some came back. Got down to my 8th step. I looked back on my 4th step. Then I had to add a couple people on my 8th step. Then I had to go out there and repair the damage. Make direct amends with such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Made a list of all persons we have become willing to make amends to them all. The willingness. My sponsor told me, Candido, willingness will take you but so far. You got to act. Action. You got to go out there and do this. So you know what? My first 13 amends was not accepted. They were rejected. They're like, you're a scumbag. Get away from me. I went back to my sponsor. I said, man. He said, okay, let's open the book up. Then it talks about this man who got thrown out of the office. Suppose he does get thrown out of the office. He said, it's water over the dam. We've done our part. I demonstrated my part. So what? It wasn't accepted. Trying to move on. So in the midst of moving on, I still got some amends today, about 4 more amends that I can't catch up with the individuals. But wherever possible, I'm willing to make that amends. So I go to this 10th step, and for 5 years of my continuous sobriety, I didn't even know how to practically do a 10th step right. I thought that I had to wait at the end of the night to do it, continue to take my personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. For 5 years, thank God I didn't drink. To this dude named Scott, that showed me the outline of the 10th step. He said, Candido, we got to ask God to remove that selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. He said, anytime it crops up, it says when these crop up, and they're going to crop up. And I had to resolutely turn my thought to someone I can help. And I started to do that. At the end of my night now, I'm writing down where was I selfish? Where was I dishonest? Where was I resentful? Where was I frightened? Every night. And then I move on to the 11th step, which is sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him. Praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Now, if you look at the mark on my forehead, like I said, I'm from the Islamic denomination. Anytime there's not a mark on my forehead, then I'm not praying. I'm not prostrating to my Lord. So watch out, put your wallets where they need to be. And it says, let's not be shy on this matter of prayer. Let's not be shy. And you know what my sponsor told me, Candido, man? It comes down to pray or be prayed over. Makes sense. Pray or be prayed over. God removed that deadly and merciless obsession from me. Why not pray to Him? So I started to use the third step, the seven-step prayers, in my prayers every morning. Go to the 12th step, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. We tried to carry this message to alcoholics and practice these principles in all our affairs. In the midst of me being on this step, my little brother got murdered right in front of me, April 22nd, 2005. What was I to do? Called my sponsor up. He said, I don't have that experience. But what I can suggest is that you condone your family, you go bury your brother, and then you work with another alcoholic, chapter 7. Practical experience shows nothing assures immunity from drinking than intense work with other alcoholics. It works when other activities fail. Go back to doctor's opinion. Bill W., without even going through the steps, wanted to present his conception and ideas to other alcoholics, impressing upon them that they must do, first must in the doctor's opinion, that they must do likewise with still others. It was mandatory that I did that. Vital, rewardable if done, and punishable if not done. I worked with another alcoholic after I condoned my family. My best friend, AJ Quintman, got murdered. I condoned his family, sat with him, threw dirt on him in the grave. That night, I worked with another alcoholic. My first cousin gets murdered of the same Islamic denomination as me. They call me in. The leader of the community calls me in. Candida, well, you know, a.k.a. Jafar, we need you to wash your cousin's body, your first family member. We need you to wash his body. The hardest thing I've ever had to do. Wash my cousin's body. I washed his body from right to left. Wrapped him in shrouds, put the Islamic oil on him. Wrapped them up for the next day, buried them. Before you know it, I was working with another alcoholic. The obsession to drink did not return. And you know what? I don't even think about drinking. I don't think about drinking. And the only time that I think about drinking, the only time alcohol crosses my mind is when I'm in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, man. That's real talk. Thanks for listening.